like that, do you?
I don't mind.
Well, that's the message we've been sending out. I wouldn't answer the marijuana question.
That's President George W. Bush, then governor of Texas, in a secretly taped conversation with Douglas Weed, laying out his rationale for why he won't answer the marijuana question. I ask, do you want your little kid saying, hey, the president doesn't answer questions about his drug use, therefore, daddy, I'm not going to answer your questions about my drug use? I mean, he is rightly concerned about setting a bad example for the youth of America. And I commend him for that. But what kind of an example is he setting up for the youth of America by refusing to answer the question? It wouldn't fly in the house I grew up in. If I came home, I was never caught. My older brothers were caught repeatedly. Why? Well, they used marijuana more than I did. Therefore, they were stupider than I was on a regular basis. And therefore, stupid people often get caught doing stupid things. Well, it wouldn't have flown in my house for my dad to say, have you been smoking this? And my older brothers to say, I will neither confirm nor deny my marijuana use. Or I'm not going to answer the marijuana question, Dad. Now, had this all taken place today, during 2005, they might have been able to say, I'm following the example of the president. The president doesn't want children to follow his example of his illegal and illicit drug use. Good. Does he want them to follow his example on not answering the marijuana question or the cocaine question? I'm looking for your answers to these questions. Is the president doing the right thing? Not the politically expedient thing, the right thing. I think we can ask this question, can't we? You say, well, in the world of politics, the rules are different. And as president, he's got to do what is politically expedient, and no one else is going to give him the benefit of being an honest man, so he doesn't want to give his enemies an opening. He doesn't want the story to have legs. I know all that's true. All I'm asking is, does it pass your conscience test? We had one caller in the last hour who's willing to fess up and say, it's not right. He should just say yes or no. Does he have to go into details? No. Maybe he doesn't even remember the details. Fine. Or is it that this is our generation's way of dealing with what we did when we were kids? Now that we're a grown up, and we don't want to afford our kids the same latitude that we demanded when we were young, and we realize that what we did when we were young was wrong, and all those pronouncements we may have made in a smoke-filled room with our friends, when I grow up, I'm going to let my kids do this, and I'm going to be enlightened, not like my old man, all completely disappeared as quickly as the smoke cleared, and we had our first children. Now, this is how we deal with it. Is this how the boomer generation deals with its past illegal activity? Do you agree with President Bush on what, I guess you could call it, his evasion on questions of his alleged drug use? 505-7850-1-800-730-2727. Do you think he should or shouldn't come clean and either admit or deny it one way or the other? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's Open Lines, Issues, etc. for the next 20 minutes, and then Phyllis Schlafly will join us to talk about Maureen Dowd's column in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and Harvard President Lawrence Summers' comments on the aptitude of women regarding science and math. Let's listen to another cut. This one is Douglas Weed, the man who made the tapes long ago in these telephone conversations with then-Governor George W. Bush in Texas, discussing the issue of cocaine use.
I think it's time for somebody to just draw the line and look people in the eye and say, you know, I am not going to participate in ugly rumors about me and blame my opponents and hold the line and stand up for a system that will not allow this kind of crap to go on.
Okay, so the president is fed up with a system that is political blood sport, defamation of character. And that's what these questions are asked to do. Everyone knows this. It's about defaming character. So he doesn't want to participate to the overall ugliness of the political discussion. Now, in order to do that, is it necessary to not answer questions about cocaine use, not answer questions about marijuana use at all? Tim is calling from his car. Tim, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Todd. I mean this in the most polite way, okay? I think that as far as character is concerned, I don't think marijuana use, specifically marijuana use, I'm not talking about other drugs, I don't believe that impugns a person's character to where they're not a good Christian. I think that I'd be more concerned if my kid grew up and had a cold heart and wasn't concerned for the poor and the working poor and the environment and issues that I think there's other Christian issues besides whether or not you smoked marijuana.
So do you think the president would suffer any... I mean, everyone is assuming that he did use this. He just doesn't want to talk about it. Do you think he would suffer any ill effects or any diminution in his the way his character is perceived if he just said, I did smoke pot and I did use cocaine?
No, I think it's just about as silly as saying, I mean, is it an issue when kids are underage smoking cigarettes or, you know, underage drinking? Or haven't we all been drunk at one time in our life as Christians, most people, you know? I think those are just as about on the same level as using marijuana use.
All right, Tim. Now, that might have been a sidelong attempt to talk about decriminalization. I don't know. You know, I used to be, and I'll be completely honest, I used to be like, hey, I don't think that decriminalization is such a bad idea. Until my kids are old enough to actually engage in the activity I would like to decriminalize. And then suddenly decriminalization becomes a really bad idea as a father of a kid who has access or could have access to illicit drugs. My mind has changed on that since I got a teenager. When I was a younger parent thinking, again, those grandiose thoughts of what the utopian world would be like, not anymore. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Matthew's up next. He calls from South St. Louis.
Hello, Pastor Todd.
Hi, Matthew.
I just wanted to make a couple observations. One, I think in order to question whether or not it's legitimate for President Bush to refuse to answer, I think we have to ask the question, is it legitimate to ask the question? And by what authority do they have to ask the question? I noticed that Jesus... his political enemies, the Herodians and whatnot, oftentimes asked him questions, and they had a very ulterior motive. They didn't want to know the truth. They merely wanted to crucify him, quite literally. And I think that's the case here, too. We have a legal tradition that a man has the right to remain silent and not incriminate against himself. And your children are totally different. They're under your authority. We have a legitimate right as parents to ask our children, where have you been? What are you doing? Even what are you thinking? But in the case of the president, does this have any pertinence to his office? And I'm not even a strong supporter of the president. But
what if your kids asked you about your previous drug use?
Well, on that case, I've never used drugs. However, on other subjects, there might be questions I might be uncomfortable in answering.
Well, I'm not asking about whether you'd be comfortable. Would it pass conscience test as a parent to say, I'm not going to answer that question?
Well, I think that it would come down to a legitimate motive of me and what I thought was the best for my children. Because quite honestly, I think it may be an issue where, you know, if your children look up to you very strongly, they may very well. I remember when I was a kid, let me just put it this way. When I was a kid, my dad would tell me certain stories about what he did, and he said, no, I don't think I want to tell you much more than that because you might be encouraged to do the same. And you know what? The things he did tell me didn't. I love my dad so much. I think it did make me say, I want to be adventurous like dad. I want to do this or that. I did do certain things.
All right, so, Matthew, thank you. Okay, now this is how I'm hearing it, and tell me if I'm wrong. That is it relevant to his presidency now? No. But that's not the question I'm asking. I'm not asking whether it's relevant to his presidency or to his fitness for office. I'm not. I'm asking, does it pass the conscience test with you? Let's forget for a moment, or maybe it is, that if I'm president, I can do this kind of stuff. Is it really true that being president kind of gives you a pass from the conscience test for 4 years? I mean, that's what Clinton's supporters argued. They said what he did wasn't illegal. What he did may have been unethical, but it wasn't illegal. And it's not relevant to his performance of his duties in his office. Now, people would say, oh, yes, it was. Okay, go ahead and make your arguments. Would you cut the same slack for John Kerry if he were president now? And suddenly, after 1 month in office, tapes came out about him, where he was laying out his strategy as then senator. I'm not going to answer the question. I'm not going to answer those questions. Would you cut them the same slack? Honestly, please. Oh, please be honest with me. Don't say, oh, yes, I would. I would cut them the same slack. Think about it for a moment before you immediately say, I would. 505-750-1800-730-2727. Or maybe it's just that when you get elected president, a whole new set of rules come into play. You're no longer a man who stands before other men and God having to pass the conscience test on questions like this. And I, in answer to Matthew or to the callers, do they have the right to even ask the question? I don't think the president, even himself, would say, no one has the right to ask me that question. I don't think even the president is making that assertion. By the way, the last time I checked, it was government of the people, by the people, for the people, and the people have the right to inquire of their elected officials. Don't they? I mean, doesn't the president answer to us? Now, he might want to make the case that he doesn't have to answer. He is making the case he doesn't have to answer this question with us. And does that pass the conscience test with you? 505-780-1800-730-2727. Teresa's up next. She calls from St. Louis. Hi, Teresa.
Hi. I wanted to comment on you saying that about telling your children what you did in your past.
Sure.
As related to this. And from my personal perspective, I have had three teenagers, and I would have to say that when you disclose what you've done in your life, you open the door for them to do it then. And that as an adult and having hindsight, we can see what's wrong. But if we tell them what we did, they don't have the hindsight or the wisdom that we do at our age.
To what activities does that extend?
Well, like...
We're thinking like drug use...
Exactly.
Premarital sex, things like that parents would be really uncomfortable discussing with their kids in any event. But what about, I mean, we do it all the time as parents. Don't we say, I once drove over the speed limit and got a ticket. I don't want to see the same thing happen to you. We do disclose wrongs we have done with our kids all the time in order to say to them, let me give you the benefit of my hindsight. Don't we?
Exactly. You're right in some cases, but I think with like drug use and premarital sex and things that, you know, everyone drives over the speed limit. Not everyone smokes marijuana, and not everyone has premarital sex. But probably everyone has driven over the speed limit. It's discernment about what you're talking about. And if you tell your kids, yes, I did it, they can throw back at you when they do it, well, you did it. I'll ask you one whole door for them.
Okay, but what about then the president saying he doesn't want to set a bad example for kids by admitting to this, but what kind of an example is he setting for kids by refusing to answer the question? What kind of an example is he setting for our kids by refusing to answer the question?
Well, since when is it that when our kids ask us a question that we automatically owe them an answer? Why do we automatically owe them an answer?
Well, that's not what I'm arguing. I'm asking you, what kind of an example is the president setting for kids by refusing to answer the question?
I don't know. That's a good question.
All right. Thank you. I think it is a good question. That's why I ask it. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And I'm not trying to play against the president's rules here. These are the standards he set up in his own comments. He doesn't want to set a bad example. Let's commend him for that. And I think the previous caller Teresa made a good argument for presidents and parents being careful about being full disclosure with everything they ever did, because you can, how should I say this? You can, without intending to, encourage or open the door for your kids to do things. That's just, she's right. That's true. But what kind of an example is the president set by saying, I'm not going to answer the question? How often can you get away with saying, I'm not going to answer the question? I'm not going to answer the question. Claire is calling from St. Charles. Claire, welcome.
Hello.
Hi, Claire.
Hi, Todd. I just wanted to say that I think he should answer yes, that you should be more forthright with your children, and he should just say that he did it, it was foolish, and now look, I got to answer, you know, I've got this problem going on. That's what I think.
Yeah, look what it's cost me.
Right.
You know, thank you very much, Claire.
Mm-hmm.
What would it mean if what would it mean if the president were to say, I did it, and look at what I did all these things, and look at what I'm the price I'm paying. I'm still answering for it 20 years later. I am still ashamed of what I did, and I'm still made ashamed of it by people asking me questions. Didka was supposed to run, the Republican Party was after Didka to write, to run for, against Barack Obama in the senatorial race. Remember this? Now, Didka could have walked away with that easily. The Chicago vote alone would have got him into the Senate in Illinois. He could have been a U.S. senator. What did the former football coach say? Why didn't he run? He said, I cannot, my past will not bear up. He didn't say it in these terms. He's not as articulate as that. My past will not bear up under the scrutiny. I could not pass the background test. He knew what going into politics would mean. I could not pass the background test. I mean, the president could say, yes, I did, and I am still paying for it, at least in the public sense. So, kids, don't do it unless you want to be answering for it with an employer 25 years from now. Paul is calling from New Melle.
Hi, Todd. It's the assumption is being made in the public square that perhaps the president did. I'll just go back to history. In the sense that he was an officer in the Air Force National Guard. He was a pilot. He would have to have lied on his security clearance papers that you have to fill out and, you know, background check, and would have been subject to, if found to have used drugs, would have been subject to prison time. Also the fact that when he was on flight status, he would have been routinely checked for drugs. So I feel that he's in one sense, he's answered the question.
You don't think he did
that period of time?
You don't think he did it?
I have no idea. The man hasn't told me, and I'm going to put the best construction on it, but I will say he did serve. And, I can tell you that if I had lied when I was in the military about the use of drugs, I might have found myself in Leavenworth, too, with the type of work I did.
Paul, thank you for the call. Okay, Paul doesn't think we're going to give the president the benefit of the doubt. He didn't do it. It would have been too difficult for him not to pass the drug test, or he would have had to have lied in too many junctures in the military, in the Air National Guard. In order to have done it, maybe he wasn't using drugs during those days. Don't know. He hasn't said. Now, I would say, in response to Paul's speculation there, and of course this is speculation because the president isn't saying. And how damaging is speculation? If he didn't use them, then isn't he free to say no? Then he's not setting a bad example for anybody. Then all of these arguments, I'm not going to set a bad example for the kids, so I won't answer the question. That doesn't make any sense if he didn't. Because he could say no. He could be like so many people that a previous caller mentioned, not everybody smokes pot in their youth, who can say, no, I never did. Never did. And we wouldn't be talking about this. I mean, that's my response to Paul. If he really didn't, he could say no. And people could still say, oh, he's lying. But if he can honestly say no, then he can honestly say no. 5 more minutes left in open lines, issues, etc. Give me a call, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I'm glad the president is trying to set a good example. I am. We're talking about the president's refusal to answer the marijuana and the cocaine question. That has come to light, of course, because of the Douglas Weed tapes last week. Now, he did say this, and this is from the ABC News account here. He did say this. And after saying he wouldn't answer the marijuana question, he said, Douglas Weed said that the president brought up the subject of past drug use often. Now, for a man who didn't do it, didn't use illicit drugs in the past, and is just for some other reason refusing to answer the question, that's kind of odd that he would bring it up. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Phyllis Schlafly will be our guest in just a few minutes from the Eagle Forum. She's offered this book, Feminist Fantasies, and her latest book is called The Supremacist. We're going to talk about a statement made by Harvard President Lawrence Summers on the aptitude of women for science and math, and I'm interested to hear what Phyllis has to say about that. I don't know where she's going to fall on that one. And Maureen Dowd's column in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch today on feminism, something near and dear to Phyllis's heart. She'll join us in just a few minutes. Now let's listen to something non-drug related in the secretly recorded phone conversation between Doug Weed and then Texas Governor George Bush.
He's saying that you promised you would not appoint gays to office.
No, what I said was I wouldn't fire gays. I'm not going to discriminate against people.
Now, this is the one that I think people, the mainstream press might be more interested in because it has to do with the gay question, and that's more current. Drug use is kind of old news. But who he hires and who he fires, he will not appoint gays? No, he will not fire gays. Now, I will point out that, and this takes a little memory, you might have to jog your memory, when the president did cozy up to log cabin Republicans during his presidential run, when the president did appoint openly gay people to positions, not cabinet positions, but to staff positions and things like that, and when there were openly homosexual people working in the White House, he kept his promise. He didn't fire anyone for being homosexual. And he did hire them. He did not discriminate. But he was also criticized by Christian evangelicals for doing it. 505-7850-1-800-730-2727. Mike is calling from his car. Hi, Mike.
I think maybe the reason he didn't say no was because the effort that the press and the other people would have put in trying to prove him wrong probably would have caused more damage than answering it the way he did.
So, okay, Mike, let's assume for a moment that you are now president of the United States. You, Mike, are President Mike. You've never used illicit drugs in your life. Let's assume that also. And the press said, have you ever used cocaine? What would your answer be?
My answer would be no, because again, I'm not sure that my answering that directly might not cause more damage because the effort they're going to go to prove me wrong. The press is certainly leans a little bit more to the liberal than the conservative side. I just can't imagine they wouldn't have just gone full bore trying to prove that he did take drugs.
All right. Thank you very much, Mike. That's kind of a convoluted argument to say that the president didn't use drugs. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. In a few minutes, Phyllis Schlafly will join us from the Eagle Forum. We will talk about Maureen Dowd's column on feminism and what the Harvard President Lawrence Summers thinks about the aptitude of women in math and science.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Issues Etc. relies on a small group of faithful supporters called our Issues Etc. Reformation Club. These people have pledged to become monthly or annual contributors to Issues Etc., and this allows us to budget our expenses more efficiently. Now, here are the three levels of giving. The confessor, $25 monthly or an annual gift of $250. The apologist, $50 monthly or an annual gift of $500. And the reformer, $100 monthly or an annual gift of $1,000. Now, each Reformation Club member receives premiums like monthly tapes, books, and transcripts. You can join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club today by making a tax-deductible gift payable to Issues Etc. Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Help us reach our goal of 125 Issues Etc. Reformation Club members by Easter. Issues Etc. Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Terry Phillips sitting in for Bob Dittmer. The United Nations is calling for a ban on all human cloning. A new resolution will hopefully set the tone of the debate around the world. Stuart Shepherd reports. In a major victory for those who value life, a key UN committee passed the resolution supporting a ban on human cloning 71-35. It calls on nations to prohibit any attempts to create human life through cloning processes and any research intended to achieve that aim.
It sends an international signal. It sends a good signal.
Thomas Jacobson with Focus on the Family was at the UN when it passed. While not as binding as a formal treaty, he says it does set the bar high.
This is the standard that the majority of nations support, and hopefully nations will then craft their own laws to prevent all forms of human cloning and to restrict research so that they're not destroying human embryos in the process of their research.
Well, the ban is a non-binding resolution, but it does call very strongly for nations to pass national laws banning all forms of human cloning.
Austin Ruse with the Catholic Family and Human Rights Institute hopes one of the nations to be influenced will be the U.S.
We do hope in this particular situation that it will have some weight with our U.S. Senate, which is also considering a ban on human cloning.
He says the politicians opposing a U.S. ban are generally those who also place great importance on the stand taken by the United Nations. For Family News in Focus, I'm Stuart Shepherd. Officials in China and South Korea have already signaled their intentions to flout the resolution. Even now, China allows human cloning for research purposes. The resolution will next go to the United Nations General Assembly for a vote that's generally considered to be a formality. It's expected to pass. For Family News in Focus, I'm Terry Phillips.
On the next Midday Living Jubilee, live at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO. Join Paul Clayton and me, Diane Summers. We'll talk with Michael Redman, who's Communications Coordinator for the St. Louis County Police Department. It's getting to be that time of the year. Sky warns severe weather observer training is coming up. We'll find out about that and a lot more on the next Living Jubilee, 11:05 Thursday on AM 850 KFUO.
Israel's conquest of the Holy Land comes alive in our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February, the Concordia Commentary on Joshua. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about this commentary on our website, issuesetc.org. The Concordia Commentary on Joshua, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February.
Maybe you're one of those people who you notice the shortage of pastors in the church. My own church body, this is across denominational lines, but I'll speak about my own church body, is about 1,000 pastors short, 6,000 congregations and 1,000 pastors short. That's a big shortage. That's a big shortage. Not making up for men who die, retire, and the guys who are graduating from seminary. And maybe you're one of those who sits around and say, why aren't there more young men going into the ministry? Well, with all due respect, let's put our money where our mouths are. Christ Academy 2005 is an opportunity to encourage in a tangible, two-week way a young man, high school-aged, to become a pastor, to help make up for the shortage of pastors in the church. Christ Academy 2005 is a two-week residential program for high school-aged men on the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. They get to go to class, go to chapel, meet the faculty, sit in the actual classes that seminary students sit in, get a real taste for it, interact with the students. They also have a lot of fun as well. They're taken care of in a very decent manner. They will not be encouraged to either use illicit drugs or to later evade questions about them. And you'll be encouraging young men. You'll be doing something rather than simply diagnosing the problem. Tell your pastor that you are willing to foot the bill to send a man to Christ Academy 2005. He'll track down the man. He'll make the arrangements. And if he wants information, he can go to our website, issuesetc.org. Right there on the homepage, scroll down a little bit. You'll find the Christ Academy 2005 logo and next to it, a link for more information on this residential program during this summer. Now, There's also a toll-free number that you can call. This is the toll-free number for Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, 1-800-481-2155, 1-800-481-2155, or as I said, go to our website, issuesetc.org, and get some more information there. You can quit whining about something like this and actually do something about a shortage of pastors. It's not really that complicated, and all it takes is you approaching your pastor and saying, hey, I know of someone, or do you know of someone, and I'll pay for it. Phyllis Schlafly will join us here in just a moment. I was on vacation for the last week. By the beneficence of my mother-in-law and father-in-law, they took the whole family, 19 people all said, and more than half of them kids, 11 children, and then their own kids and spouses on a cruise. And it was beautiful. Got to see, right in the middle of February, stand almost naked in on a beach. Bathing suit, by the way. And, Jeff found that distasteful. That image burned into your mind. Believe me, I saw the pictures. They came back from Walmart last night. You don't want to see them. You don't want to see a bald-headed man in his 40s standing on a beach. Take him out of the picture. The beach is beautiful. We spent a lot of time on the boat, too. Now, if any of you have been on a cruise, you will know exactly what I'm talking about. Is your pastor a cruise director? You know, the seeker-sensitive branch of the church growth movement, which says the audience is sovereign. The people who walk through the door, they are sovereign. Not God's word, not what God's word teaches. The audience is sovereign. Their felt needs dictate what you preach, what you sing, what you do, what you offer by way of amenities at the church. The audience is sovereign. It's a market-driven strategy for making the church grow. It's called the seeker-sensitive approach. It turns pastors into cruise directors. The cruise director on our cruise was a delightful little guy who was ebullient. He was happy. He was always up. He was excited. And his job, apparently, was to keep us happy and excited. Behind the scenes, for the most part, he coordinated all of the activities, made sure all the staff was working. I think the captain didn't do anything except simply navigate the boat. The cruise director was in charge of us, the passengers. Sometimes we were a captive audience. We would hear from him on a regular basis. We'd hear the ship's sound, or whatever that little sound they make when they want everyone's attention, and then the cruise director would tell us everything that was going on. Any whim you had, culinary, by way of adult beverages, by way of, if you wanted to gamble away your life savings in the casino, if you wanted to sit on the beach and do nothing but turn into a piece of bacon in your beach chair, if you wanted to sit at the bar and, I don't know why you'd want to, but you would, sit at the bar and spend those 7 days in an alcohol haze, they were there to accommodate you. And he was there to make sure it all happened. I mean, many people, you've seen the commercials for the cruises, haven't you? The people come back from the cruise and they say, I was a king, I walked among kings, every night my bed was turned down. That's what it's like. Your every need and every whim is attended to. If you want room service, you get room service. If you want two entrees at dinner, you get two entrees at dinner. If you want three desserts, you get three desserts. No one tells you no. You are sovereign on the cruise ship. They are there to make you happy. Now, as to your needs, do you need to sit in for 7 days in an alcohol haze at the end of the bar? Or bacon scent? No, you don't need to do that. In fact, they probably should be sued for a lot of skin cancer. But it's not about what you need. It's not about what's good for you. It's about what you want for those 7 days. It's a lot like a lot of churches. The pastor is the cruise director. Your whims, whatever they may be, are catered to. You can't be wrong. But you also can't be unhappy either. Every night before the show, I went to most of them. We gather there in the Palladium Lounge at the front of the ship, and the whole ship is rocking back and forth. And there, the place probably held 500 people, 600 people. It reminded me a lot of these modern churches. Tiered balconies, the floor, the stage. If you put maybe a kind of a perfunctory little pulpit in there, it would have passed for any modern church. They had a band. The band, and I thought a lot of these seeker-sensitive churches could take a hint from this band. This band was down in an orchestra pit for the most part. But whenever the band was featured, it would magically rise from the orchestra pit. And they'd do their thing. And the band director, he got everybody hyped up. That was his job. They came out, they played music. They were as good as, I was thinking, this sounds like Doc Severinsen. Now, I'm dating myself. This sounds like Doc Severinsen and the Tonight Show Orchestra. And it wasn't that big. I loved the music. We sat up in the balcony so I could look down and see the band. That's what I was really interested in. The dancers held no interest for me. If I wanted to see women scantily clad, I could walk up to the Lido deck and see women scantily clad. The dancers did not interest me. The band interests me. I'm watching them. The band leader came out. His job was to get us worked up. So when the cruise director came out, we'd really be worked up. The cruise director came out. He asked three questions. It almost was a liturgy kind of a thing. It was formulaic. I know he'd done it a million times with a million groups of people on the boat. It reminded me a lot of Sunday morning in some churches. Instead of the perfunctory good morning that you get at a lot of churches, and a lot of them aren't just good morning, good morning. My pastor comes out and says good morning. That's about the tone, good morning. Some pastors nowadays, that's not good enough. Good morning! And if the people don't literally shout it back at them at the top of their lungs, I can't hear you. Is it really good? You don't sound like it's good. Tell me that it's got to be good. It has to be a good morning. Your house might have burned down. Your dog might have died. You might have your wife in the hospital. You still have to tell the pastor good morning, even if it's the worst morning of your life in a lot of churches. This is the way the cruise director was. I'm trying to figure out whether the cruise directors are like pastors or the pastors are like cruise directors. I can't figure out who's imitating who. For all I know, this cruise director had been to some of these churches to get some hints on how to enforce happiness. He asked three questions whenever he appeared on the stage, even if he appeared just to make an announcement. Are you having a good time? Say yes. And the people would say yes, kind of like that. And that wasn't good enough. Are you feeling good? Say yes. Everyone had to say yes. He really wasn't happy until everyone said yes, so he always asked that third question. Are you enjoying yourself? Which I thought was a telling question. Not are you enjoying the cruise? Did you enjoy the island? Are you enjoying being with your family? Are you enjoying the food? Are you enjoying yourself? Because after all, that's what this is all about. You, yourself. Are you enjoying yourself? Say yes, he would demand, and eventually everyone, except for Wilkin, who is the big... ask my wife, I'm the worst person to go on a cruise with because I just don't get into enforced happiness. I like real happiness. The kind of happiness that comes with, the kind of happiness that comes on the flip side of the coin of real life. Are you feeling good? Say yes. Are you having a good time? Say yes. Are you enjoying yourself? Say yes. And I thought, if I closed my eyes and ignored the fact that this room was rocking back and forth, I could be in church on any Sunday morning in almost any church. The music, the enforced happiness. By the way, folks, don't get me wrong. I had a great time on this cruise because it wasn't church. It was just a cruise. No negative emotions were permitted. None. Now, they were there, but we weren't allowed to acknowledge them. Have a great day. The Mater D every night. Have a great day tomorrow and a bright sunshiny day, even though it rained for the first 4 days of the cruise. He still said, have a bright sunshiny day, because on the cruise, it doesn't rain. There are no rainy days in modern evangelicalism either. Have a bright sunshiny day, even though it may be raining. Busy, busy, busy. That's the other way it reminded me of the church today. The cruise director's job was to keep us all busy. He had everything lined up. You could go ashore. You could stay on the boat. You could, whatever you wanted to do, there was always something for you to do. It wasn't about actually getting anything done. It was about just staying busy. For the kids, they had Camp Carnival. You could send the kids off. It was like children's church or nursery. You didn't have to see them. You could go to the show without your children. because they were catering to our whims. And the other thing that reminded me, and this is my last comment on this, the other thing that reminded me that was seemed so similar to me between the seeker-sensitive church and this cruise was we weren't allowed to look behind the scenes because it was all carefully orchestrated for us. We didn't see where the crew slept. There were 1,500 waiters, waitresses, bellmen, I don't even know what you call the people who turn down your bed, cabin boys, on this boat. You only saw them when they were doing their job. They were always in a uniform. They were always happy. They were always saying hello. It made for a great cruise. But I knew for a fact that they had to stay someplace. They weren't sleeping in the closets. I know where they were sleeping. I checked it out. I had to peek into an unauthorized area to see the fact that they're sleeping in, you know, eight to a room in bunks on the very lowest part of the boat. And but we weren't allowed to see that behind the scenes because their job was to make sure everything worked seamlessly. It was manipulative. It was enjoying. But, you know, that does not become the church. A lot of the churches today are like this. You don't see behind the scenes where the music director is saying to the band leader at some point in the service, we've got to switch this song for that song because the people aren't excited enough. We need to change the mood. Where they are purposefully choosing music or whatever happens next in order to steer you in an emotional direction. You don't see that happening. On a cruise, that's their job. That's what you pay them for. In the church, I think we could be a little more authentic and honest than that, don't you? Just some thoughts after going to a cruise that reminded me an awful lot of church. Phyllis Schlafly is our guest. She's president of Eagle Forum. She's author of several books, including Feminist Fantasies and her latest about the Supreme Court called The Supremacists. We're going to talk with her about Maureen Dowd's column today in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch on feminism, raising a lot of eyebrows, and a recent statement made by the president of Harvard University, Lawrence Summers, on the aptitude of women for math and science. Phyllis, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hello, Todd. Always good to talk to you.
Give us your thoughts on Maureen Dowd's column today in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch.
Oh, she's just a sour feminist. When the feminist movement got going in the 70s, one of their big things was they wanted women to be just as sexually free as men. They had to show they were just like men. And, of course, now they're all crying around that men are treating them like sex objects. It's there's no rational basis.